Hi, and welcome to My Unknown Truth, a podcast that focuses on individuals and how they have navigated their unique adoption story. My name is Nadia Levitt. While going through my own adoption journey, I wanted to create a space for others to share their adoption journey too. Kat wrote her adoption story in 2020 and shares it with us in this episode. Born in August 1971, her story begins from age 2.5 in 1973. Kat incredibly accesses some of her earliest memories, recalling a series of significant events, experiences, and emotions that extend into her teenage years and adult life. The world she grew up in was a safe and loving environment. However, throughout her life, she always felt a part of her was fragmented and unknown, and her struggle with identity led her on a prolonged search to find her biological mother and father. Kat's powerful and detailed recollection of her life explores her biology, health, ancestry, and the complex pathway that led her to uncovering some deep emotional truths.
So this is my story. I was born on the 30th of August, 1971. Was I a New Year's Eve fling? At the time, my biological mother was living in Potts Point, where I'd say she met my biological father, who frequented the area and lived and worked nearby. Owing to her immediate family situation, she didn't feel she could raise a baby herself and resolved to have me adopted. Shortly after I was born, I was adopted by my mum and dad, Jerry and Brian. Mum and dad were led by the adoption agency to believe that my biological mother was 5'2", honey-coloured hair, blue eyes, and couldn't afford to raise me on her own, so she gave me up for adoption so that I could have a better life than she was able to give me. They were also told that my biological father was Northern Italian or Mediterranean descent, 6'2", blonde hair, blue eyes, and that I'd presumably grow to somewhere between the two. 2 years later, Mum and Dad adopted my sister. I've known I am adopted for as long as I can remember. Mum would read my sister and I stories of adoption for children, interspersed with the usual children's books. Day to day, I didn't feel my life was any different from any other child in a Sydney suburban family. It wasn't until the arrival of my cousin, when I was about 2.5, that I started questioning things. Everyone was fawning over him, comparing his looks with those of the rest of the family. His nose, eyes, ears, hands, feet. Nobody said anything about him looking like me. I started to feel different, and this went on with each new addition to the family. Whenever this kind of normal family talk arose over the years, I would retreat to my nana's bedroom to cry, then distract myself to sit looking through her jewellery boxes till someone noticed I was missing, usually Nana. She would find me while retrieving one of her lace handkerchiefs. Nana and I were close, and she was of great comfort to me all of her life. She would draw me into a hug and I would say, "I'm not like the others." And she would say, "You're all the same to me." From the age of 3 or 4, I would sit in my bath and exhaust my poor mum with questions about where I came from and about my real mum. She'd tell me my mummy wasn't able to look after me, and it was because she cared for me that she gave me to her. It was never far from the front of my mind, and questions were triggered by almost anything as I tried to understand my world. Mum tried to explain it with a little plaque she placed on my chest of drawers, which read, "Not flesh of my flesh, nor bone of my bone, but still miraculously my own. Never forget, for even a minute, you did not grow under my heart, but in it." In about third class at school, I began to hate being adopted. I felt ashamed of it. Kids at school said my real mum and dad didn't want me. So then I did my best never to tell anyone I was adopted, and the questions to my mum became more and varied. My young mind, and until recently, my much older self, was constantly trying to reconcile why a mum and dad would give up their baby alongside the very real love I received from mum and dad raising me. Why didn't they want me? And my lack of physical likeness to anyone became an internal monologue for so many years. There was a period of time I truly believed there was something going on that no one wanted me to know. There was a boy in my class in primary school who had a sister in the same class as my cousin Linda. The mother used to always say to me, "Gee, you look more and more like Linda every day." So I began to wonder if my aunt and uncle were my real mum and dad, and that they gave their baby to my mum and dad because my mum and dad couldn't have children. It seemed logical. I looked like their youngest daughter, according to Mrs. Campbell. Sometimes people would say I looked like my mum or dad. Publicly, I would smile. If mum and dad were with me, I'd look at them. Mum usually had a fixed smile and dad would hug me. Later, I'd remind them that the comment was made and I'd say how silly the person was because it was impossible. In year 8 at high school, I skipped school when I realised what genetics in biology entailed. I couldn't participate in assignments related to family, not the tongue rolling and the fun the others all had figuring out how they got their eye colour. And history was also a source of anxiety as peers talked about their ancestors' origins, which fed into where they fit into Australia's rich cultural development and immigration following of World War II. It was never lost on me that some kid had called me a Dago in primary school, so I knew early on not to mention what I did know of my ancestry to avoid further hurt. At a private girls' school, with peers well-versed in their ancestral lineage, I felt like a mutt. Dad had called the neighbour's dog a mutt and explained to me it was a bit of this and a bit of that. At age 16, I began my search for myself. Mum and Dad were divorcing, my first true love dumped me, and I lost my best friend. I doubted myself in every way and felt really lost. Mum and Dad were not surprised that I had outgrown the limited knowledge they had of my biological parents, which they received from St. Margaret Hospital staff on the day they collected me. Mum helped me obtain the non-identifying information about my biological parents from community services, and they became Marianne and Dennis, again to be outgrown, but the backbone to much more. At 25, I had been married for the first time round about a year. We were thinking of children and history of family health. I went to Mum and Dad and explained I had to find Marianne and Dennis, assuring them both I loved them and that I wasn't searching to replace them. It was just something I needed to do. They held up their chins and assisted me in whatever way they could. Community services provided the remainder of what they held on file, but for my father's name, which was said to be noted on file but couldn't be revealed without the consent of my biological mother. I also obtained all of my hospital birth records, including some counselling notes detailing some of Marianne's apprehension, and this brought some comfort after for so long thinking I was truly unwanted. I joined the reunion information register and applied for my original birth certificate. My biological father wasn't listed on my birth certificate, and I've learned at the time mothers were unable to list fathers without their consent, nor could unmarried mothers list fathers, full stop. Mum suggested I apply for Marianne's marriage certificate extract. That would make it easier to find her had she changed her name, and upon receiving it, Mum set about locating where she and her husband lived via electoral rolls on microfiche. I made my first contact with the Benevolent Society and attended meetings with other people party to adoption, which gave me strength and hope, as well as sadness for those people who search a lifetime to no avail. I thought of Mum and Dad. This ordeal couldn't have been easy on them. When they collected me from the hospital 26 years ago, they never imagined that one day they might feel threatened by my biological parents. To them, I was theirs. I know my mum lived in fear all of our growing up years that our biological mothers might turn up one day and try to take us away from her. And then there it was. I'd reached my first milestone. My search for Marianne was over within 3 months. My birth certificate surprised us all too. Marianne had named me. Mum and Dad hadn't been told this, and I didn't feel like a Danielle. I got in my car and drove to where she lived at the time she was pregnant with me. I just sat there in my car for ages, imagining someone who looked just like me, only pregnant, coming and going. The marriage certificate extract arrived next, and it revealed Marianne married 7 years after I was born, and Mum found her address, coincidentally living 10 minutes from Dad on the far north coast of New South Wales. Mum cried a lot that day. I wrote to Marianne. It was a couple of weeks before my 26th birthday. The waiting game had begun. I also thought she might never respond. My 26th birthday was like any other day. Following a day of calls and catch up with friends, I was preparing to go to dinner with family. And as I headed out the door, a call, which I anticipated from a school friend living in London. It'd be a quickie, I thought. A foreign voice identified herself as Marianne and asked to speak to Catherine. Holding my breath, I bleated out, "Oh my God!" Marianne and I spoke on the phone for about 30 minutes. She had received my letter a week prior but wanted to surprise me on my birthday. I learned I had two brothers, Barry and Adam, and a sister named Natalie, who was desperate to get on the phone and speak to me, so she did, cutting in several times during this first call. She told me my birth date was always circled on the kitchen calendar and her mother was usually in bed sick for days leading up to it. Now she knew why. Marianne and I spoke again over a week later on her birthday, and we met a few weeks after that. With my letter to Marianne, I had included a photograph of me. I had no photograph of her, and believing this was the day that my identity crisis would be over, I figured she looked just like me. I was so nervous leading up to meeting her. I had seen adoption reunions on television over the years. Mum used to look at me for my reaction, and I used to find all the emotion rather too much. I recall thinking, these people don't even know each other. How can you be so emotional over a complete stranger? And where was their caution? Before I knew it, Marianne was in front of me, and her first words were, "Jesus Christ, you look just like your father." Those words bounced around in my head over and over for years afterwards. Caught up in our initial and surreal curiosity of each other, we sat at lunch for 4 or 5 hours, really drawing breath. But a seed of identity so important to me had been sown, and so far I was a little disappointed to lack a likeness with her. And the topic of my father had been neglected all lunch but for this. She told me she and Dennis had been apart about a month when she realised she was pregnant with me, and having made her decision to have me adopted, she contacted him to let him know she was pregnant. Marianne said that he offered to assist with an abortion, but being Roman Catholic, that wasn't an option for her. Then she declined his offers of marriage and support. Eventually, he respected her decision to have me adopted, and both decided to move on with their lives and not make contact again. I went on to find only a very small likeness with Barry, which was more a facial expression, really. And it was obvious my height at 5'2¾" took after my mother. Admittedly, my hair, which was as an infant was white blonde, had turned honey coloured, but finding my father became more necessary than ever, and Mary Ann refused to break the pact she had made with him, nor would she tell me who he was or where I might be able to find him. So I wrote him a letter and sent it to her and asked if she would please forward it to him. She didn't ever confirm whether she had done so, but I figured it wasn't common for men to change their names, and that it wouldn't take much for her to find him if she wanted to. And the letter was from me, not her, so there was no breaking of any pact on her behalf. Natalie would later go on to tell me that she thought her mother had forwarded the letter and proudly added that she had raided her mother's things and thought Dennis was a Gemini from Western Australia, but she couldn't find anything else. I moved to London from 1997 until 2005, during which time I stayed in contact with Marianne by writing letters to her. In 2005, I returned to Australia. Mum and Dad were now both living on the far north coast, so I stayed between the two of them till I found a job in Sydney. Marianne lived closer to Mum than Dad, and so when in coughs, I'd visit Marianne. For a short period, we found a lovely closeness and spent a bit of time together. I recall staying the night at her home and waking up feeling really strange to have slept under the same roof as her, my biological mother. And I had slept very well. Then making my way from the bedroom to sit with her having breakfast felt so weird. There we were doing something so natural to most people, but for us, for the first time in our lives. It was a foreign concept to me. Soon after this, she remarried and I let go of her due to a complex energy that I felt between Natalie and I. But I wasn't done. I needed to find Dennis.
So Kat had reached her first milestone in finding her biological mother. A bond was established and a seed of her identity had been sown. But the search was far from over. Finding her biological father remained, the journey long and challenging. Kat tried every possible pathway to discover her truth. Letter writing, private investigator, creating a Facebook page, DNA testing with 23andMe, GEDmatch, engaging a genealogist, accessing community service files, Ancestry DNA, the Benevolent Society, hospital records, the police, and the ties between known families and relatives was what it took to finally reach him.
For 20 years, I would look for my face in the faces of tall, blonde men everywhere, particularly when in Italy, due to the reference of him potentially being Northern Italian. In 2011, a judge friend told me the laws around adoption had changed and I was likely to be able to receive Dennis's name now with little effort. I couldn't accept it would be that easy. It was too easy to find Marianne. I felt it in my bones that finding Dennis was going to be difficult or that I wouldn't reach him in time. Instead, using all the information I had gathered since I was 16, I placed an ad in a West Australian newspaper in 2013. To which a private investigator responded, telling me none of the details I provided were enough to conduct a search, but a military identification number would find him within a day. I didn't have one. I felt downhearted about ever finding him and wasn't ready to get my hopes up and torn down by bureaucratic walls to seek release of his name with changes in the law. In 2014, I made a Facebook page to try and find him. I ended up helping a few people, but I didn't find him. I ended up marrying a Northern Italian, and certainly not by design. I had fallen in love with Francesco many years prior at the gym. And in 2016, while undergoing IVF, he and I did DNA testing with 23andMe, just to be sure we weren't related. This established geographical ancestry and distant family. We hoped maybe we might learn some health information as well. But alas, being Australian, we were not entitled, as Americans were, to the health information. And while we were happy not to be related, we were shocked to find no Italian ancestry for me. Instead, German. The Irish I already knew belonged to my maternal side. Soon afterwards, I received contact from a maternal third cousin who found me via the ancestry tool GEDmatch. This was a very special moment of feeling included that I'll never forget. Someone in my biological family had found me and came looking for me. Thanks, Michelle. In 2018, in the midst of studying for my yoga teacher training diploma, I was struggling with meditation and Dennis kept coming up. So I reached out to Marianne on Facebook in one last attempt to ask for full details of his identity, but she shut me out. Then in January 2019, my friend Tamara introduced me to Lisa, a part-time genealogist, convinced that she'd be able to map out my family tree and find Dennis. Lisa was rather calm and matter-of-fact about being able to, and within a couple of weeks, she had populated my maternal side up to about five generations with over 2,000 relatives, including Michelle, who had found me already. Lisa then insisted two things. One, be brave and obtain Dennis's full details from the community services file. And two, do the ancestry DNA test as it was the most widely used. Brave was not something I would ever have called myself. So I spat in the tube and following the submission of certified identification, statutory declaration, and not to approach Dennis or his family without an intermediary, such as the Benevolent Society, I had Dennis's full name within a fortnight, and within an hour of sharing his name with Lisa, she found he had died 12 months prior. I had missed him, and my heart sank. Dennis left behind a son and a daughter. I contacted the Benevolent Society, who reached out to his children. His son, Harley, was open to getting to know me and provided his mobile number immediately to chat, and we did for almost 2 hours, getting to know each other and particularly about Dennis and the upbringing I might have had. Harley was not surprised to hear from me. His mother had got a call many years back from a daughter she had adopted out as a baby, and at that time, Dennis admitted to the family that he would not be surprised if someone came looking for him. Since Dennis only fit 3 points in the non-identifying information, and I wanted to be certain he was my father before accommodating Harley into my life, and we got all loved up as siblings, I asked if he would mind taking a DNA test at my expense, which confirmed Dennis was not my father. I suddenly felt relieved, because that meant he might still be alive, but I also felt exhausted and I knew I had to find the energy to continue. Shortly after my ancestry results came in, I was immediately matched with two important people. One was Marianne's first cousin, Joan, who I met and continue to meet for tea and scones and to hear family stories. And two, my first half-cousin, Dale, on my father's side. He and I hit it off well. However, he didn't know his father and his parents had split before he was born. Being a sensitive situation, Lisa and I went to great lengths to protect Dale's privacy while going after what we were looking for. His father's name led Lisa to my paternal grandmother, Elsie, and her immigration in 1952 from Germany with a baby boy, Dietmar. That baby boy was my biological father. At first, it would lead us to Dale's younger siblings, Nicole and William, who he knew nothing about, and it was a great joy for me to bring them all together. Leaving their father out of the scene for sensitive reasons, it was Nicole who led me to our Uncle Marco, who knew all there was to know about the family. Uncle Marco flew to meet me, and the instant he shared a photograph of his brother, I knew I'd found my father. There wasn't anything specific, but it was a very strong knowing that leapt out at me without a shadow of a doubt. Uncle Marco advised me, among many things, that he hadn't seen or heard from my father, Dietmar, since their mother died in 2012, and that due to his lifestyle, he may have already passed away, and if not, he was unlikely to be in good health. He also told me that Dietmar had changed his name to Alexander after their grandfather, who was likely the only person in the family who had shown Dietmar any kindness as a child. Lisa and I were almost certain, due to the documents we found and my cousin's DNA status of first half cousins, that my father and his siblings shared the same mother, but that Dietmar had a different father. Uncle Marco felt it to be true too, and that it would explain a lot about their upbringing. On 7 November 2019, I spent the day searching every likely place, including hospitals, within a 20-kilometre radius of where Uncle Marco suggested Dietmar might be, but to no avail. I felt that feeling of too late creeping up again. In the following morning, driving to work, I thought of an avenue that I hadn't previously considered. I parked my car, raced to my office and closed the door behind me and called the police. I asked to be put through to missing persons, and the conversation went like this. Me. Hello there, I'd like to discuss a possible missing person. Police. Is the person missing for sure? Me. Well, this is the last known whereabouts. He is my father. I'd like to know if he's okay. Police. Are you in regular contact with him? Me. No. However, I had lunch with his brother this week and he said he hadn't seen him for a while and he was last known to be living in this area. His name is Alex. Police. I can't see him. Me. His birthday is 20 June 1950. He'd be turning 70 next year. Police. Is it spelt D-I-E-T-M-E-R? Me. No, it's spelt D-I-E-T-M-A-R. Police. We have someone fitting that. We could send some boys around to do what we call a welfare check. Me. I understand fully. Due to privacy laws, you can't give me his details, but do you think they could give him my contact details? Police. Sure, I'll call you back. That chap didn't call me back, and I was in no way prepared for what happened next. The officers went round to check on him and called me back from my father's home. And with little information on their part, they put him on the phone to me. I heard, "We've got your daughter on the phone. Would you like to speak to her? It's Catherine." I heard him say that wasn't his daughter's name. He took the phone from the officer and he asked me if it was some kind of awful fucking joke. And I said, "No, please let me explain." I said, "I'm Catherine. My mother is Mary Ann, a lady you had a relationship with in 1970. Do you remember her?" He'd gone from rough to quiet. Thinking he might not believe me, I tried to summon something else to keep him on the line. He said, "Brooke is my daughter and she lives in Sydney. Where are you?" And I said, "I'm Catherine and I live in Sydney too. I have heard of Brooke, but I don't know her." Then I said to him, "I met your brother this week and he told me where he thought I might find you." At hearing his name, my father swore a lot about him and then his past. It was a tirade. I was shocked and I didn't know what to think. All I could think of was, what have I done? Then he seemed to accept it. The police took the phone back from him and assured me that while very frail and not in the best health, there was no alcohol about, the place was a little messy, but he was an elderly man living alone and not so unusual in their experience. The officers asked him if he would allow me to have his address and telephone number, and he said yes and received mine. My father called me after the police left and we spoke for about 10 minutes. In that short amount of time, he told me some horrors about his life that stacked up with what Uncle Marco had implied. The mention of his family was a very sore point for him, and so I told him up front that at this point the DNA suggested he didn't share the same father as his two brothers and sister. He swore a lot about his half-brothers, mother and stepfather, but underneath the angry and hard-hitting exterior was a man who had been deeply wounded and scarred. He was also quite vulgar, as Uncle Marco suggested. Marco's wife preferred to call him funny and fond of a joke, and I conceded that this definitely shone through. I was calling him Alex and he was insisting I call him Dad. I recoiled. There was only one dad in my life. Alex would always be Alex. Alex didn't know I existed. He remembered Marianne. He said she liked to go to Manly on the ferry, which was really funny because that's where I live. She tried to get him to go to church with her, and she had a beautiful peach of an ass. That was hard to hear. Otherwise, he tried to commit suicide after she broke up with him, and then he found her with some army guy who I now know was Dennis. I reached out to Harley as soon as I found out his father's connection to Marianne. Otherwise, the only fit to the non-identifying information from community service for Dennis was that he spent time in the armed forces and liked to drink. Like Alex. Harley and I are still in touch. He affectionately refers to me as his temp sister. We take comfort in knowing how Marianne and Dennis were connected, and it still fills in some gaps for Dennis's brothers about his whereabouts during that period in Sydney away from Western Australia. I wasted no time in meeting Alex. He agreed to take an ancestry DNA test, so I ordered it, and as soon as it arrived, I booked flights to go and meet him. I was terrified, but I had to do it. I was terrified because leading up to going, he had sent me some obscene and irrational emails and scary photographs, and I didn't tell Lisa or Francesco for fear that they would stop me from going. But I did everything I could to ensure my safety. It was obvious Alex had a mental illness, and he told me on the phone that his doctor diagnosed him with emphysema and suggested he might have schizophrenia. A psychologist friend would later suggest to me the details I shared sounded more like borderline personality disorder. The day before my flight, I booked a restaurant and told them I was meeting my biological father for the first time and that I was a little scared. They were very supportive and told me they'd look out for me the entire time. I booked a taxi for myself from the airport to the restaurant and back again. I booked a taxi to transport Alex to and from the restaurant. I arrived at the restaurant an hour early and worked with the owners on a table and my signals to them, as well as how to suggest I was moving Alex on and for them to let the taxi know it was time to come for him. During the lunch, Alex was calmer than the emotion and content of his emails and text message suggested he might be. He spoke about his life, which was so very tragic, a life of mental, physical, and sexual abuse and neglect from his mother and stepfather, which led him to living on the streets at about 12 years of age. He spoke awful things about his entire family and the life he had lived. He wanted me to find my half-sister Brooke. I kept tight-lipped about Lisa having found Brooke a few days before I flew to meet him because the very nature of what he was saying about the relationship with Brooke's mother made it clear to me that they were not in contact with him and unlikely ever to be, so I wanted to preserve that distance from him for them. I was certainly regretting he had my address, and well so, he sent me all kinds of weird stuff in the mail and over 80 emails in the first 2 weeks of finding him. Soon after meeting Alex and a little time to reflect, I wrote to him how deeply saddened I was by what he had endured in life and that surviving as he has been truly amazing. Lacking a nurturing family and support had him learning about life in extremely harsh circumstances and that this was seriously impacted all of his relationships. His trust is understandably non-existent. Therefore, his responses to interpersonal exchanges are extreme and irrational. I suggested it was not healthy to live with so much anger towards so many people and at the world, and perhaps he might try to write it all down, get it all out, then have a personal ceremony of burning it and letting it go, because he is safe now and I wasn't going to tell anyone where he was. No one can find him and hurt him anymore. So my biological parents had a relationship. Neither of them deny this, as their stories attest. Their story was long enough to take ferry rides to Manly and for Marianne to hope that Alex might embrace the church. I don't dare to ask for anything more, but if I could, perhaps a photograph of them in that time together and smiling. A great calm began to fall over me. I'd done it. I had reached my goal of finding both my biological parents. Neither of them could ever replace Mum and Dad. I was humbled. I knew where I came from. I was connected to my ancestral family and the lands they had roamed. Some of my ancestors weren't just names. They were faces and stories with more to be told. My feet fell with certainty of who I was. There was an altered perspective to my world and I was proud. And never before did I feel so grateful to Marianne for giving me up and to Mum and Dad for adopting me. I realised my resilience and determination, and I appreciated my adoption more than ever before and in a whole new way. Ironically, on New Year's Eve of 2019, I took up the invitation to attend a shamanic healing to shed the past, and there I let go of the false narratives that have travelled with me throughout my life. I have had to filter Alex's emails because their content can provoke anxiety in me, and the path of his life remains really quite traumatic. I choose to keep distant from that. And Marianne, I wrote to her in March of 2020 to tell her I found my biological father. She and I haven't been in touch since 2005 or 6, but Joan has told me Marianne will reach out to me again when she is able. And that's my story.
The views expressed by interviewees in this podcast are their own and are not necessarily endorsed by the Australian Adoption Podcast. We acknowledge different individuals, families, cultural and ethnic groups, and NGOs will approach these sensitive issues from differing perspectives. Thanks for listening. Join us next time on My Unknown Truth.